Do we know what Jesus taught? The fourth talk in a series titled Christianity and Truth was presented by Ron Julian on October 16, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Tonight I'm going to be having some comments about what is known as the Jesus Seminar. In recent years, we have seen numerous newspaper stories and television documentaries about the new search for the historical Jesus. I don't know how many of you saw Peter Jennings hosted a show this year sometime called The Search for Jesus. A year or so ago, Public Broadcasting had a program called From Jesus to Christ, the premise being that we started out with the ordinary man, Jesus, and somehow the church turned him into the Christ at the end of the process. The thesis of programs such as these is that the followers of Jesus after his death put words in his mouth that he never said, and claimed miraculous actions that he never performed, including the great miracle of the resurrection. Modern scholarship, they tell us, can separate out the Jesus of history from the Christ of faith. These programs seem to have captured a fair amount of attention. I run into people in various contexts, not infrequently, talking about the ideas that these programs have brought up and sort of asking, well, what about that? I am a person who actually believes that the account of the life and teaching of Jesus in the Gospels actually is true. And so the question comes around, well, why aren't you embarrassed by that show? I mean, haven't they demonstrated that, in fact, if you're truthful and scholarly and look at the evidence, that there really isn't any reason to believe that those things happened? That's what I want to talk about tonight, is why it is I'm not embarrassed to, well, let me put it this way, why I am not embarrassed by what the Jesus Seminar in particular has argued. It is not my purpose tonight to argue for the authenticity of the Gospels. That would be another topic. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be talking about the authority of the Scripture and what view of its authority it presents and why I think we should accept that view, and that maybe will be closer. Here, though, in particular, what I'm concerned with is, if we're going to be people who are interested in the truth, then what sort of attitude should we have towards these scholars who come along and say, our scholarly work has shown that there is a lot of falsehood in the story that's told about Jesus in the Gospels? Now, in these programs, like the two that I mentioned there, there are certain names that show up fairly frequently. You see John Dominic Crossan, or Crossan, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, Marcus Borg, Robert Funk. These and a number of other scholars make up a group that is referred to as the Jesus Seminar. It formed several years ago, and their purpose was to meet together and to come to some sort of consensus together about what it is that Jesus did say and what it is he did not say. What it is that he did and what it is that he did not do, as it's reported in the Gospels. And they got a lot of publicity because they sought publicity. I mean, they put out a lot of press releases and they were very anxious. They saw themselves as doing work that was important, bringing to the average person a new understanding of the Gospels. And one of the things that got a lot of attention in their procedure was the method of voting that they had. They have four categories. And their informal description of the categories was, for any given saying that they were looking at, if it was a red saying, then that means that's Jesus. If they voted pink, then, well, it sure sounds like Jesus. If it was gray, then that means, well, maybe. And black means there's been some mistake. So there are four possibilities. How strongly are you convinced that this saying either is or is not a genuine saying of Jesus? And they would vote I think it was marbles or colored pieces. They would put in there the colored pieces and they would count them up, and then they would use an averaging system to come up with the score that they would give to each saying. And ultimately they published a book where it's like a red letter edition of the Bible, only it's a red, pink, gray, and black edition of the Bible, of the Gospels, where all of the sayings are color-coded as to how much that they're reliable. And not surprisingly, as you go thumbing through it, you don't see a lot of red. Now, some of the conclusions that they came to, I'm quoting from the book The Five Gospels, which was their report, that red letter edition that I'm talking about. Jesus did not ask us to believe that he was the Messiah. He certainly never suggested that he was the second person of the Trinity. In fact, he rarely referred to himself at all. Jesus did not call upon people to repent or fast or observe the Sabbath. He did not threaten with hell or promise heaven. Jesus did not ask us to believe that he would be raised from the dead, and Jesus did not regard Scripture as infallible or even inspired. So those are some of the conclusions that they came to, and there are a lot more that we could look at. What is it that we should think about this? As I said, why am I still a person that takes the gospel seriously as an accurate representation of what Jesus said and did in the light of what they have said? Well, I do want to say that it's important that the Jesus Seminar is making a strong claim about truth. I mean, they are saying, look, we need to face into things squarely. It may be fine to have a nice pretty picture that you're going to go to heaven one day and so on, but we need to be brutally realistic and honest about what really went on there. They have harsh words for Christians who take the Bible to be recounting real events. They say we're superstitious, they call us naive, and they have a number of terms that they would use. But they see, and it is not too much to say, not too strong to say, that they see their job as to rescue us from our superstition. If we only had access to the sort of understanding that they do about the scholarly and historical research that can show that Jesus, in fact, said very little of what it is that he's reported to have said, and that we get an entirely new picture of Jesus. When we put together the little bit that's left that he did say, we see that he was a very different guy than the picture that we get from the church. When we have been shown that, we will be liberated from superstition and misunderstanding. And they're basically calling us. I mean, it is a call. They are sounding the alarm. They are telling us we can either hide our heads in the sand and believe in spite of the evidence, or we can courageously face the truth that Jesus is not who we think he is. I'm not setting up a straw man or anything there. That's the kind of language that they use. They really do see themselves, at least a number of the most prominent members, really do see themselves as being on a crusade to rescue us from ignorance. So this series is all about Christianity and truth. If the evidence suggests that Christianity is not true, then we would want to know that. I mean, my attitude is that there's no virtue in believing the Christian gospel if it is not true. So They're throwing down the gauntlet and saying, look, are you going to be reasonable or not? And my answer to them is yes. By all means, let's be reasonable. I want to join them in being reasonable about what it is the Gospels are proclaiming. Now, I'm just warning you that some of the stuff I'm going to talk about tonight has the potential to be sort of technical. I'm not going to say boring because, of course, I can't be boring. That's not possible. I can't imagine that you could go away being bored by anything I have to say. Which is my cute way of saying is that I really am afraid that you are going to be bored. So I'm warning you up front. What I'm trying to do here is give you kind of a taste for the issues, some of the issues involved and why I look at them the way I do. I'm not expecting you to go away with all of the details that I'm talking about here. And indeed, if you're interested in pursuing it, there's a lot of material out there that you can look into. But I'm just trying to give you a taste for why it is I can say I believe that I'm a person who wants to know the truth. I believe that I'm a person who's interested in following the evidence where it leads, and I am yet not particularly interested in what the Jesus seminar has to say. So that's what I want to talk about. In order to consider the claims of the Jesus seminar, I'm going to have to say something for a minute about the role of presuppositions in our knowledge. And I don't know how much that's come up yet in the discussion that we've had already about truth in this series. But you have to understand how I look at this in order to see how I'm putting this together. I believe it's a normal and natural part of human knowledge that as we live our lives, we build a picture of reality. Each of us has a world view. We have a way of thinking about things, things that we believe are true. And as we, through experience and consideration of life and so on, build this worldview, we use it. We take it and we use it as a tool to interpret the world around us. We build up this worldview and we're not embarrassed to use it to decide, oh, okay, that claim is not true and I think that in this situation this is what's going to happen and so on. We use the worldview that we put together. I mean, to make a really obvious and simple sort of example, when you pick up a ball and you drop it, you don't say to yourself, maybe this time it will fall up. After all, I don't want to be prejudiced. I mean, the fact is that what happens is experience has taught me that gravity is operative always on the earth, and I expect that it's going to operate. I take it for granted that it's going to operate, and I conduct myself accordingly. I don't say I'm going to withhold judgment until I put it to the test. I have already made an assessment that that's the way the world is. We do that with a lot of things, and I think that's how we learn. That's how we make progress, is we come to conclusions and then we use those conclusions to come to new conclusions. And we use those conclusions to come to new conclusions, and we all do it. I do it, you do it, we all do it all the time. We also know, however, that sometimes we can come to conclusions that we start to build into our presuppositions that are wrong. We can believe things that are not true, and we can use those beliefs to come to further beliefs. And the whole foundation, the whole structure that's built on the foundation of that wrong belief is shaky, and probably a lot of it's not true because I've got a wrong assumption at the heart of it. And sometimes what has to happen is something has to come along to challenge that belief so that the whole structure can come crashing down and I can build again on something that's more reliable. So maybe, you know, here's the story. I'm engaged to be married, and I believe that my fiancé is in love with me, whereas, in fact, what the reality of the situation is that my fiancé is just after my money. And she's going to marry me and then find some way to take my money and go away. Well, For a while, I'm going to interpret her actions in the light of my belief that she is in love with me. And I'm not wrong to do that. I mean, everyone has beliefs and we operate out of them. But sooner or later, reality is going to hit home where there's going to be enough tension between my belief that she loves me and the actual way that she behaves towards me that that belief is going to come into question, and maybe I'm going to abandon it and get a new belief. That's the way human learning works. So, having presuppositions is not bad. I am not here to charge the Jesus Seminar with being illegitimate in their approach because they have presuppositions. They're not wrong to have presuppositions, but I think their presuppositions are wrong. And so I can't go where they go because what they assume in the process of what they're doing, I can't go there. At least, now, my purpose tonight is not to convince you that their presuppositions are wrong and that mine are right. My purpose is to show you that there is a difference, that they do have presuppositions, and that your evaluation of the truth or falsehood of what they're saying is going to ultimately depend not on their scholarship, but on your assessment of the presuppositions that have led to that scholarship. Because it is not true that Christians who believe the Bible, to take it seriously and think that Jesus is what he is portrayed to be in the Bible, it is not true that they are people who ignore the evidence. There are many, many well-educated, believing Christians, scholars and students, who know all the same facts that the Jesus Seminar guys know. And yet they come to different conclusions, and it has to do with the presuppositions that they bring to the evidence. So, in order for me to talk about why I respond in a certain way to what they do, we have to talk about the presuppositions involved. There, from my perspective, there's no way around it. Okay, the main presupposition that I want to talk about, probably this won't be surprising to many of you, but the foundational presupposition of the Jesus Seminar, and they're pretty upfront about it, I would say, is, I'll call it just generally, an anti-supernaturalism. The idea that the supernatural, at least in the terms that the Bible describes it, does not happen. I'm not prepared to say that there isn't a Jesus Seminar participant who doesn't believe in ESP or something like that. I'm not prepared to say that. But, I mean, I don't know. But in general, the foundational assumption that they bring to the text of the Gospels is that things like what we see reported of Jesus saying and doing do not happen. We know that to be the case. Therefore, that's the fundamental principle we can use to sort out what things he said and did and what things he didn't say and do. Because there are certain things that he has reported as saying and doing that we already know in advance he did not say and do. Because people do not say such things and do not do such things. The book, The Five Gospels, has a dedication, which reads in part, "This report is dedicated to Galileo Galilei, who altered our view of the heavens forever." And to understand why they have that dedication, I want to read you something from the book itself. This is just, probably most of you are familiar with this, but in this statement he refers to the Scopes trial. And you'll remember that the Scopes trial was the trial where Clarence Darrow defended a man against the charge of teaching evolution. That he basically argued that, yes, he taught evolution, but the law that said he shouldn't was a bad law. And it's a famous trial in American history. It is seen as the classic battle between ignorant Christians and educated, thoughtful scientists. So, here's the quote from the book. "The contemporary religious controversy, epitomized in the Scopes trial, and the continuing clamor for creationism as a viable alternative to the theory of evolution, turns on whether the worldview reflected in the Bible can be carried forward into this scientific age and retained as an article of faith. Jesus figures predominantly in this debate, the Christ of creed and dogma, who had been firmly in place in the Middle Ages, can no longer command the assent of those who have seen the heavens through Galileo's telescope. The old deities and demons were swept from the skies by that remarkable glass. Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo have dismantled the mythological abodes of the gods and Satan and bequeathed us secular heavens. Historical knowledge became an indispensable part of the modern world's basic reality toolkit. Apart from this instrument, the modern inquirer could not learn the difference between an imagined world and the real world of human experience. To know the truth about Jesus, the real Jesus, one had to find the Jesus of history. The refuge offered by the cloistered precincts of faith gradually became a battered and beleaguered position. In the wake of the Enlightenment, the dawn of the Age of Reason, in the 17th and 18th centuries, biblical scholars rose to the challenge and launched a tumultuous search for the Jesus behind the Christian facade of the Christ. Okay, so I just can't emphasize enough how great a part this plays in the conclusions of the Jesus Seminar. I mean, what I want you to understand is you're at home, you're watching Peter Jennings, and he is having an interview with a scholar, and a scholar says, well, you know, we know here that, of course, this particular thing wasn't written until much later than the time of Jesus, after everybody had forgotten what it is that he actually said and did, and they made it up for the purposes of furthering their own religious agenda and so on, whatever particular argument he's making. And you hear him saying, we know this stuff. And, of course, the question that comes to your mind is, how is it that you know these things? How is it that you have discerned that this is, in fact, what's going on? Well, I can guarantee you, I mean, it's not that there aren't pieces of evidence out there being considered, but there are also pieces of evidence that have been set aside. I mean, specifically, so this is not relevant information. And the reason is because that particular piece of evidence might suggest that the Gospels were actually true in this regard, and we already know that that's not the case. The foundational assumption is it's not true. There is a guy, Jesus, back behind this, but it cannot be the Jesus that is portrayed in the Gospels, because we all know Galileo has shown us, look in the sky up there, there's flaming balls of gas. There's no God. So we can't go there. Well, I mean, I really think I'm being fair to their perspective. This is the foundation, the bottom line for what it is they're doing. So the idea then is basically that modern scientific people cannot believe in the kind of God portrayed in the Bible. We know in advance, before we look at any evidence, that Jesus did not rise from the dead, walk on water, predict the future, or do anything miraculous. We know in advance that he is not coming back at the end of history to judge the world, because we know that such things don't happen. Now, I think the Jesus Seminar scholars, to their credit, are quite upfront about this. I mean, they're not trying to hide their presuppositions. They're proud of it. And they think that I am, not me personally, I don't take it personally, but that people like me are naive for thinking otherwise. Okay, so I have a couple things to say about this. First of all, the fact that these are scholars who think this does not make the presupposition any more likely to be true, because it is not their scholarship that has led them to conclude this. You do not become an anti-supernaturalist by learning Aramaic and studying historical documents. That's not where such conclusions come from. They have taken a philosophical position. They've looked at the world and they say the view of the world that makes sense to me is this one. And so The question of the truth of their presuppositions is not a question of historical documents or that sort of thing. It starts with the issue of, is the philosophical position that they have taken a defensible one or not? Are they right that no thinking person could embrace the supernatural view of the universe that we find in the Bible? Well, like I say, it's not my purpose here tonight to defend that idea, to defend theism here. But I will say that their philosophical position doesn't make sense to me. It seems to me to have all of the sophistication of, when I was young, I remember, I may be getting the details wrong, but I think it was Yuri Gagarin who did this. He went up, the Russian cosmonaut went up into space, and when he came back, he said, I was up there, I looked around, no God. Therefore, Christianity is not true. Well, that is not a philosophically sophisticated perspective. There, no thinking person, I would say, who has embraced the faith believes that the issue is whether I go up a few miles in the earth and open a door somewhere and there's God. That's not the view that we have. And I would argue that that's not the view that the Bible portrays either, although some would argue that it does. All I'm saying is, I think theism has a good, at a minimum, it has a good fighting chance. If it has a fair opportunity to get in the ring with other philosophical perspectives, it can hold its own. And the casual dismissal of it by the Jesus Seminar is just, it is intellectually dishonest. It doesn't commend itself. If they want to come along and say, we're prepared to take on the philosophical issue of theism, and here's our argument, and that's what we're trying to convince you of, okay, let's do that. But in fact, what they do is they come along and they say, everybody knows that's not true. And anybody who thinks it's true is just being naive and hiding their head in the sand. Well, that's just name-calling. That's not argument. So from that perspective, I think we have the right to say this foundational presupposition that they bring to every question that they address, they haven't really made the case that it's true. Now, if I were to come to share that presupposition, then I could build on the foundation that they have put down and take their arguments and see where they go. But the problem is I do not share their presupposition. And there's nothing in the evidence that they point to, nothing in the texts that would make me abandon my belief in theism. It's their unbelief in a God like that has led them to interpret the evidence the way they have. So we're at an impasse. Before we can go and look at a particular text and they say, well, I vote that one's black, Jesus didn't say it, I have to say, wait a minute, before we can start talking about that, we have to go back and talk about what are the philosophical presuppositions we're using when we make that assessment to begin with. So for myself, I'm not, like I say, I'm not here to argue this, but for me, the picture of reality in the Bible makes sense. I think it's defensible. It fits the world as I know it. It is compatible with scientific inquiry. And in fact, many have argued that the Christian worldview gave rise to scientific inquiry in the West. So I'm not buying that. They can say it's obvious that it's true, but I don't believe them. So that's one way in which I'm not prepared to go there. Okay. Now, moving on. Since the presuppositions of the Jesus Seminar tell them that the accounts in the Gospel cannot reflect what Jesus actually said and did, they're left with a basic skepticism about the texts of the Gospels. Obviously, for them, now the task becomes explaining how did we come to have these documents in the first place? We don't have these documents because Jesus said and did those things and somebody wrote them down. We have these documents through some other process. probably there's this guy Jesus back behind it, but who was he and what was he really like and how did it end up being so different? That's the task that they have set themselves. And what they have tried to do is set out objective rules and criteria for how do you decide which statements are Jesus and which ones aren't. So for the rest of what I want to say tonight, I want to talk a little bit about, I mean, there are a lot of them, and there's a lot that we could say about any one of the criteria that they use, but I just want to point to a couple of things that they're big, they're things that they appeal to quite a bit, and make a few comments about them. First of all, and I think, if I remember correctly, I basically have three things I want to talk about, three things that they do. Number one, the Jesus Seminar is not, this is not the first group of scholars who have taken on the task of trying to discover the historical Jesus. This work has been going on for a long time. There have been a lot of scholars throughout this century. There have been people dedicating themselves to this task and trying to separate out the Jesus of history from the Christ of faith. And there is a rule, a criterion that has been in operation throughout this century, really, that scholars have used, and it is one that the Jesus Seminar has picked up and uses as well, as though, although they don't call it this. It used to be called, in older redaction criticism of the New Testament, used to be called the criterion of dissimilarity. And the idea is basically this. Does something that Jesus said agree with what other Jews at the times thought? Then it's probably safest to assume that Jesus didn't say it. Does something that Jesus said correspond with what his later followers believed? Then it's probably safest to assume that the church made it up and put it in his mouth. Okay, now, I hear the laughter. I understand. I do want to defend this as being not as stupid as it sounds, although I ultimately think it is not appropriate. It is not a good criterion to use. But there is more to it than might appear on the surface. The only things that you can be safe about assuming that Jesus actually said, according to this argument, is things that are truly different from the culture around him and what his followers said later on. So, for instance, in the five Gospels, they argue that when we come to the picture of the Last Supper, and we have Jesus talking about this is my body, and eat, you know, and do this in remembrance of me, and all of that stuff. Their argument would be basically, well, we know that the later church had this liturgical practice of practicing the Lord's Supper. Therefore, if you're going to have a liturgical practice, you need to have some justification for it. So what you do is you put it in Jesus' mouth that he told you to do it so that you have a reason to do it later on. Now, that, I mean, if you stop and think about it, it seems crazy. And I heard your laughter. I think some of you agree with me. It seems crazy. Because the assumption seems to be, if you think about normal life, there's this guy, and he says things, and I'm trying to decide if he really said the things that he's reported as saying. Is it likely that he would share perspectives with some of the people in the culture around him? I mean, Jesus was a Jew. Is it surprising, would it be surprising to us that he would have a perspective on things that was similar to some of the Jews around him? I mean, is that an outrageous thing to think that would happen? Actually, that's pretty reasonable. That probably would happen. And likewise, if we have a guy who has a bunch of people who become his disciples and become his followers, wouldn't you think that it would be reasonable that they would end up remembering some of the things that he taught and agreeing with him and practicing things that he said to do and believing things that he said were true? I mean, isn't that kind of the definition of having disciples, is that the people go on to think about things the way you think about things? I mean, even if Jesus is wrong in what it was that he said, wouldn't you think that it would be reasonable that at least some of the things he said, his disciples would end up believing, since they were, in fact, his disciples? And when you stop and think about it from that perspective, of course, the answer is, well, yes, of course. I mean, many things that he said will be believed by the people who came later. And many things that he said would be believed by the people in the culture around him, because they were Jewish and he was Jewish, and they would have shared many things. That makes sense. So why then the criterion of dissimilarity? Where did that come from? Are they just being like stupid? I just say, oh, well, no. What they're being is skeptical. The criterion of dissimilarity is a criterion that says, I don't have confidence that this text is showing me what he really said. And so the things that I'm going to believe he said are the things that I can't explain any other way. If it's something that his later followers believed, then it's possible that they stuck that back in his mouth. So it's safest to not believe that he said that. If it's something that other people around in the culture thought, then it's possible that somebody put it in his mouth. And so the safest thing to do is to say that we know for sure that he said the things that were most distinctive. If it's really distinctive, then it's unlikely that his later disciples put it in his mouth, because they don't seem to have picked up on it. And it's unlikely that he got it from the culture, because nobody else seemed to think that. In fact, he seems to be the only guy who thinks it, and so it's safe to think that maybe he said it. This kind of skepticism, admittedly, in the old days, in the old redaction criticism days, I think most scholars would admit this is an overly cautious criterion to use. I'm going to end up throwing out good sayings by doing this, because it is true that the followers of someone will probably end up believing things that he taught. So if I'm going to throw out everything that he said that other disciples of his said as well, then I'm probably going to end up throwing out some things that he really said. But it's sort of better safe than sorry. I have this sort of what they might call a critically assured minimum. These are the things that I can know that this historical guy said. And for the rest of it, I don't know. That's the attitude that they would have taken. I think it is fair to say that the Jesus Seminar has taken this approach, and they have really kind of pushed it to the limit. Because they really don't talk much, from my perspective, as I read them, they don't talk about how we're just being cautious here. They use this criterion to throw out all kinds of things and pretty much say, he didn't say that. And then they take the picture that is left with the statements that you've got left and say, we'll take those and put them together and we'll see what kind of a Jesus we have. And in fact, the picture that they paint is a guy who didn't say those things. It's not just we don't know whether he did, but they tend to describe it in terms of he didn't say those things. And from my perspective, that now becomes truly invalid. I mean, if you want to say, well, we're being really cautious, that's one thing, but you haven't demonstrated that someone didn't say something just because other people who studied what he's taught ended up believing it as well. That doesn't prove that he didn't say it. But somehow the Jesus Seminar folks end up talking about it as if it does prove that he didn't say it. So in that sense, I think the way they apply the criterion of dissimilarity is not compelling. I don't see much to it. And I frankly didn't care much for the way in the old perspective it was used either. Because the question is skepticism appropriate at all? Is it appropriate for me to be skeptical about the things? Skepticism as a way of coming to knowledge. If you and I were to take this approach to everything that we try to know, we could never know anything. Because if you throw out everything that is unsafe, anything that you can't possibly come up with another explanation for why it's that way, you would find that there is very little, even in your experience, that you could accept. We don't live that way. We're skeptical about certain things. When we have reason to be, when we have found something that makes us skeptical, then we approach it skeptically and we're very reluctant to be convinced. So really, the criterion of dissimilarity for the Jesus Seminar folks comes back to their initial presupposition. Why are they skeptical about the text? Because they don't believe in the world that it portrays. In advance, they don't believe it. Therefore, they feel justified in being skeptical towards the text. Therefore, they only accept as legitimate something that couldn't possibly have been put in his mouth by anybody else, which is a pretty small list when you get down to it. Because, like I said, the likelihood that Jesus came into that historical moment totally divorced from the Judaism of his day and having no effect at all on the people that followed him afterwards is very unlikely. And the only reason you would arrive there is if you're convinced that you have to be skeptical about the text. To be scientific about it, you have to be overly skeptical about the text. So that one's not compelling to me. Second, the Jesus Seminar has a particular way that they reconstruct the picture of the dating and the sources for the Gospels as we have it. And I just want to go at this real quickly here. I don't want to go into a lot of detail, and I am not an expert on these matters, so I'm not claiming that I could anyway. But they start with a pretty classic picture that has developed over a pretty long period of time. We start with the Gospel of Mark, which is the shortest of the Gospels. And we have two other Gospels, Matthew and Luke, which are very similar to Mark. They have a lot of material in common with Mark and with each other. And maybe you've heard those three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. They seem to be looking together at the same stuff. Whereas the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, has very little material that overlaps with the others. Most of what's in John are dialogues and situations that are not recorded in the other gospels. Okay, so we start with Mark as the shortest. And Mark, as it turns out, most of what you see in Mark, you also see in Matthew and Luke. So I come up here and I'm going to put in Matthew, and probably that should overlap even more because an awful lot of Mark is in Matthew. And the same thing here, we're going to come along over here and we're going to put in Luke, and I really missed it there. That circle really ought to come over here around like that because it's mostly, most of Mark is in there. Now, what we find then is that there's some material that only Matthew has, some material that only Luke has, but there is this spot right here where Luke and Matthew together have the same material, it's similar, but it is not found in Mark. So the theory that is put forward is that Mark was the first of the Gospels, Matthew and Luke referred to Mark, but they also had something else that they both referred to that was responsible for this material that they both have in common. And you will find that referred to as Q. The Q, and usually it's seen as a document, as a collection that existed. We don't have one. Nobody's ever seen a copy of it. But the theory that people propose is that it must have existed because that's where Matthew and Luke got their stuff from, is from Q. So, you German guys, how would that be pronounced?
Quelle.
Quelle?
Quelle, German?
Yeah.
Quelle.
Quelle, okay. Means source, I'm told. Not being a German speaker, I don't know. Okay, so the Q document stands for the source document of this material. All right? Now, there is also That Q document, the material that's in common between them, there are a lot of sayings in that section, sayings that we don't find in Mark, but are common in Luke and Matthew. So, a lot of sayings there. Likewise, we have sayings in another gospel in the Bible, one that comes, we have a 4th century document of, it's called the Gospel of Thomas. It's a collection of sayings. So, like Q, they would argue, it's this collection of sayings of Jesus without any, it doesn't have any stories, he doesn't do any miracles, no narrative, it's just sayings. So the reconstruction that the Jesus Seminar folks do is this Q document and the Gospel of Thomas, they come first. It's sayings of Jesus, but there are no stories attached to them. These documents don't claim that he rose from the dead or that he healed people or anything like that. It's just a collection of sayings of this guy named Jesus that people who were his disciples sort of started to collect and pass around. Later on, after 70 AD, after the destruction of the temple, a whole generation past the time of Jesus, we start to have Mark, first of all, and then Matthew and Luke, pulling from some of these sources that have, and other sources of sayings of Jesus. But those sayings are just totally divorced from the stories themselves. And Mark basically, I mean, in essence what they say is he made up the stories. I mean, it's all, I mean, the church, people were starting to talk about these kind of things, but basically the documents they had, the stories that had been passed on from person to person had become embellished, and they started to add all of these things about how Jesus did miracles and Jesus rose from the dead and all of that kind of stuff, starting with just the foundation of some stories that were passed around about what some things that he said. That's the reconstruction that they would make. And what they conclude from that, by the way, when they say that these Gospels here are written after the destruction of Jerusalem, the reason that they say they're written after the destruction of Jerusalem is that in these three Gospels, we see Jesus predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. Therefore, they have to have been written after the destruction of Jerusalem because, as we all know, you can't predict future events. So the presupposition that we're starting with enters into the very assessment of the dating of the documents. Okay, what they conclude then is, originally Jesus just spoke in short, pithy sayings, and no record was kept of where or when he said them. So all of the narrative stuff was stuck in later. Any longer teaching things that we find are not really what he said because he only spoke in short, pithy sayings. As they say, like the cowboy hero of the American West, exemplified by Gary Cooper, the sage of the ancient Near East was laconic, slow to speech, a person of few words. The sage does not provoke encounters. As a rule, the sage is self-effacing, modest, and unostentatious. So this guy, Jesus, was a wandering sage who said a few provocative things here and there, and unfortunately his disciples down the line came up with this incredibly misguided understanding that he was claiming to be the Messiah and that he rose from the dead and all of that stuff. But he was just a guy who went around saying things like, consider the lilies of the field, and other things like that. Okay. I know what you mean, but I'm reporting here. This is how they see it. Okay. So I have some problems with this. Boy, the time is just flying by. Let me just go quickly over some of my problems with this, why it's not compelling to me, this picture. First of all, I think there is evidence that the Gospels should be dated earlier than 70 AD. for instance, the fact that clearly the same guy wrote the Gospel of Luke that wrote Acts, and Acts goes along and stops at a certain point in Paul's history, which is significantly earlier than the destruction of Jerusalem, likely because that's where the story had gotten up to that point. He leaves us really wanting to know what happened to Paul. He's a prisoner of Rome. And I think it is an unreasonable assumption that if he had known what happened to Paul, he would have said so. And other things that we could point to. But the fact is, those pieces of evidence are not compelling to the Jesus Seminar because of their presuppositions that it can't have been written beforehand. This picture that we start out with these sayings with no deeds or anything like that attached to them, I really find that difficult to swallow in the light of the fact that decades earlier than they're saying the Gospels were written, we have something like 1 Corinthians written by Paul, where he's giving an account of the resurrection. He's saying there are many eyewitnesses around who saw it happen. He tells the story of what Jesus did in the upper room and what he said about this is my body and all of that kind of stuff. So at the time when they're saying that there wasn't any of that stuff going on and all there were a few free-floating sayings that didn't have any particular stories attached to them, we see a fairly mature view of the resurrection and Jesus in action that any scholar would have to date as being significantly earlier than the time that they're trying to put these Gospels. And around the time when they're saying Q and that stuff was happening. So that doesn't make sense to me. I have never been able to figure out how they put that together. They say that they're going to write something about Paul. That would be kind of interesting to see what they do. Okay. I find this picture, because we do have Paul basically writing about Jesus and about the eyewitnesses of what happened, basically, you know, we're looking at 20 years down the line from the events of them. Now, I look at my own experience. I've been around a while. 20 years ago, I was working at a church in California called Peninsula Bible Church. I was working with a pastor by the name of Ray Steadman. I was on the staff at that church. I knew Ray. I listened to him teach for years. I liked Ray. We didn't always agree about things, but you know, I had a lot of experience listening to him teach, being with him in meetings and stuff like that. Now, it's just, I'm trying to picture how it is they're thinking that people 20 years down the line who were with Jesus for a number of years have gotten to the point where they have so abandoned everything that they knew about him that they have convinced themselves that he did all kinds of things that he did not do, said all kinds of things that he did not say, and performed all kinds of miracles that never happened. If you want to argue it was some moment of religious ecstasy that they just totally lost their minds or something, I guess I can't say that it's impossible that such a thing would happen, but I'm not saying this to prove that Jesus said what he said he did. I'm not trying to argue here the Gospels have to be accurate in everything they said. I would make a different kind of argument for that. What I'm saying is I find uncompelling this picture that there were nothing but a few sayings of Jesus floating around onto which everything else was added. I don't see how it could happen. I don't see how people could be in a spot like that. I might point out they put the Gospel of Thomas back here with Q. And this is a strange one because most Bible scholars, unbelieving Bible scholars, would argue with them that the Gospel of Thomas does not belong back there, that the Gospel of Thomas was written at least a century after all of this stuff and was written by Gnostics as a perversion of what you find in the Christian Gospels. But it's a very interesting move that they've made because by putting Thomas back there, in what what everybody else is seeing as a Gnostic heresy of Christianity, they're putting it back there and saying, that's what Jesus really said. And it's the apostles who are the heretics. They're the ones who aren't getting it right. Well, they have no evidence for that. What scholars have responded to with the Jesus Seminar on that point is they have said, you know, where are you guys getting that from? I mean, that doesn't seem reasonable to us. You don't have any evidence for it. You just like it because it helps your picture. So you put it back there. But there's really no reason to think that's the case. So now that's not something that I'm an expert in by any means. I have read the Gospel of Thomas and that's about it. But at least it's helpful to know that there are scholars out there who don't buy that picture that they're painting. Okay, now, I'm sorry, but there's one more point I want to make. I know it's running late. It's also getting hot in here, isn't it? Yeah, let's turn on the air conditioning. In fact, we're starting an air conditioning fund if we'd like to. Okay. The third point I want to make is one of the big deals to the Jesus Seminar. I really think that it is fair to say that one of the key items on the agenda, at least some of the fellows of the Jesus Seminar, is the desire to find a Jesus that they can respect. To paint a picture of a Jesus who is actually against the things that Christians believe. They want to find a Jesus who can rescue us from the Jesus that we've got now. The Jesus that we have now is a bad Jesus, and we need to find the original Jesus to come along and rescue us from the one we have. I think that's a fair and sober assessment of what it is. I mean, that's what they say that they're doing. Another one of the dedications of the book is, besides to Galileo, the second dedication is to Thomas Jefferson, who took scissors and paste to the Gospels, they say. And you remember Jefferson. Jefferson, he took his Bible and he cut it up into pieces and he took out the parts that he liked and pasted them in and made himself a new Bible that left out the stuff that he didn't like. And here's what he said. Jefferson said, "Among the sayings and discourses imputed to Jesus by his biographers, I find many passages of fine imagination, correct morality, and of the most lovely benevolence. And others, again, of so much ignorance, so much absurdity, so much untruth, charlatanism, and imposture, as to pronounce it impossible that such contradictions should have proceeded from the same being. I separate, therefore, the gold from the dross, restore to him the former, and leave the latter to the stupidity of some and roguery of others of his disciples." So, here's Jefferson saying, look, when you look at it, some of this stuff is stupid and who could believe it? Some of it is great. I can't believe that the same guy said this great stuff and this stupid stuff. So I take the stupid stuff out and I say his disciples came up with it, and I take the stuff I like and say that's the Jesus that I love, that I like. Well, it's not a coincidence that the Jesus Seminar dedicates this to Thomas Jefferson, because that's exactly what they're about. They are about coming up with a new Jesus that a person could believe in reasonably. Robert Funk speaks of as if the discovery of a new Jesus is a liberating act of heroism. He says, "The religious establishment has not allowed the intelligence of high scholarship to pass through pastors and priests to a hungry laity. And television preachers have played on the ignorance of the uninformed. In sum, we need a new narrative of Jesus, a new gospel, if you will, that places Jesus differently in the grand scheme, the epic story. Our work will spell liberty for millions." Okay, so what I want making clear here is that there are lots of people along the way who have tried to find the historical Jesus. But the Jesus Seminar has taken a particular slant on it, in that what they want to do is take out the stuff that they find unattractive and leave the stuff that they like. I mean, That sounds like a bad thing to say, but I think they have basically described themselves as doing that. In contrast to, many scholars have pointed out that the initial quest for the historical Jesus, one of the initial figures in that was the famous humanitarian Albert Schweitzer, who wrote a book, The Quest for the Historical Jesus, I think it's called. But Schweitzer concluded, as much as I hate to admit it, this guy Jesus back there in history, he had this eschatological view of things. That is, he believed that the world was going to end and that God was going to judge the wicked and God was going to establish a kingdom of righteousness and all that kind of stuff. The world was going to end and all of this stuff was going to happen. That Jesus back there had that view. And Schweitzer basically said, well, I regret it because, as we know, that's a foolish way of looking at things. And I wish that the Jesus, who I otherwise admire, I wish that he hadn't thought that stuff. But it's obvious that he did. The Jesus Seminar has come along, and they have what they call the seven pillars of scholarly wisdom that they use. And pillar number five is the liberation of the non-eschatological Jesus from Schweitzer's eschatological Jesus. Now, what they're saying basically is, we have come along and said, no, Albert, you're wrong. We can look at Jesus and like him better than you did because we can take out the eschatology. We're saying that he didn't think that stuff. He didn't believe that the world was going to end. He didn't believe that the kingdom of God was coming. He didn't believe that God was going to judge anybody and send anybody to hell or anything like that. Albert, you messed up. You got us all thinking the wrong thing. So, the description that they have then of Jesus is something like this. God was so real for him that he could not distinguish God's present activity from any future activity. He had a poetic sense of time in which the future and the present merged, simply melted together in the intensity of his vision. But Jesus' uncommon views were obfuscated by the more pedestrian conceptions of John the Baptist on the one side and by the equally pedestrian views of the early Christian community on the other. Jesus' followers did not grasp the subtleties of his position and reverted, once Jesus was not there to remind them, to the view that they had learned from John the Baptist. So, the idea is basically, we of the Jesus Seminar have decided that Jesus did not believe in this Messiah stuff and Kingdom of God stuff and that kind of thing. Therefore, anytime you see him talking about that, he didn't say that. And it leads them to some surprising conclusions, which many scholars, again, not believing scholars, but just scholars who have studied the Bible, have kind of been taken aback by, because they didn't have this agenda. For instance, one of their conclusions is that every place where Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, those are in black. He didn't say that, which is a very surprising thing from as far as most scholars are concerned, because, you know, for some scholars, probably the phrase the Son of Man is about the only thing in the New Testament that they think that Jesus said. But it's so striking a phrase and is used so often that it seems has always seemed to most people pretty likely that that's a phrase that this guy actually used. But the Jesus Seminar says, no, he didn't say that, because they recognize that the phrase Son of Man has messianic overtones. It sort of implies a vision of a Messiah and so on, and they know that Jesus didn't believe that. So therefore, he didn't say that. Another example of how they work this stuff. There are a couple of parables. Their argument would be the parables support us in this, because if you look at the parables don't have this messianic view. They don't have this view of the end of the world and God coming to judge and all that kind of stuff. And here's how they argue for that. Let's take a parable like the parable of the unjust judge. We tell a story, Jesus tells a story about a widow who keeps going back to a judge for justice, and she doesn't get it, but she keeps going back, and finally he says, okay, lest she wear me out, I'll give her the justice. Then we have Jesus giving an explanation of the parable. Now hear what the unjust judge said. Shall not God bring about justice for his elect who cried him day and night, and will he not bring justice about for them speedily. I say he will. And his explanation is basically that, like the widow, God's people who cry out to him day and night ultimately will find vindication when the Son of Man comes to bring in the kingdom of God. So the Jesus Seminar argues, okay, Jesus said the parable, but he didn't say the explanation. And then if you ask the question, so what does the parable mean? They basically say, well, it doesn't mean a whole lot. I mean, basically their answer is, well, it's just one of those kind of, you know, funny sort of things. You know, sometimes you can keep asking and asking, and eventually you get what you ask for. Isn't that kind of cool? I mean, that's the way they picture him. Jesus is just this guy. It's kind of like Will Rogers or George Carlin or someone like that, you know, who's kind of comes along and says, you know, have you ever wondered why, you know, we do this? It's that. That's who Jesus is. And then, unfortunately, Luke came along and put all this kingdom of God and stuff onto it and turned it into something that it wasn't. Same thing would be true of a parable like the unrighteous steward. The steward who's going to lose his job because he hasn't been a good steward. So while he still has the job, he goes to his master's debtors and says, here, I'm going to reduce your debt. So that when he loses his job, they will hire him. Okay? Jesus told that parable. But what he goes on to say afterwards about how we have to be faithful with the use of mammon or we won't be received into the heavenly places and that stuff, that's Luke put that stuff in. Jesus didn't say that. But once again, we're left with the question, so what was the point of the story? And again, it's just sort of one of those, isn't it kind of interesting? I can say that this guy who cheated his employer is kind of clever. That's wild. I mean, this guy, he was so clever to do that. And that was it. I mean, that was the point of the story. This guy was really clever. Is there a parallel? Is there some activity, something you want me to do with that, Jesus? No. I just think it's kind of interesting. I mean, honestly, that's the picture that they're painting. This is the kind of guy that Jesus was. He didn't go around telling people that they had to make decisions that were going to determine their eternal destiny because he didn't believe in that kind of stuff. But the parable itself is cool, and so we think he probably said that. He just didn't draw the conclusions that it sounds like. So, I mean, that's the way they do it. When they say the parables don't show that Jesus had this view of the end of the world and the coming kingdom of God, the way they demonstrate that is by they go to all the parables and strip out the parts where that's in there and then leave stories that in and of themselves have very little point as far as I'm concerned. So again, it's not compelling to me. I am much more prepared to believe in a guy, Jesus, who thought the world was coming to an end and that he was the Messiah and that he was wrong. I am more prepared to believe that than I am prepared to believe the picture that the Jesus Seminar paints, which is of this guy who never made any of these claims at all. Because the way they have put it together is just truly, to me, uncompelling. It doesn't make sense. So, my message in the end here for this is, if you see these specials and the scholars are on there saying, you know, well, we know that Jesus never said this, it was his later followers who put it in his mouth and so on, I would argue that it is not because there is strong evidence that that is the case, that they're arguing that, but rather they have a strong presupposition that the supernatural does not happen. On the basis of that, they have put together criteria for deciding which things Jesus said and didn't say that are built on that foundation of anti-supernaturalism, and it has led them to several techniques and assumptions that I think just in and of themselves, whether you believe the Gospels or not, whether you actually believe that Jesus is who he said, who it is portrayed that he said he was in the Gospels, I think the way they have put the story together is not compelling. If Jesus is not the Messiah, I'm convinced that he is not the Messiah that way. The Jesus Seminar did not get it right. He was not the Messiah another way than the way that they have painted, because their picture just doesn't make sense. Okay, so that's where I would be. So we have a few minutes for questions. I'm sorry, I just rattled on and on. I saw your hand first, Logan.
There had to come a point where, according to their view, that his followers kept reinserting or going back and inserting things into the narrative. There had to come a point where that there was a cutoff. They quit doing that. Otherwise, Jesus would be a televangelist when we pick up the Bible.
Right.
So how did they explain that these people just, Higley-Pigley just kept throwing this stuff in there wholesale, just importing it into the narrative, and then suddenly stopped? Because beliefs and practices did change through the years. How come they weren't inserted into the narrative?
I don't know the answer to that. I could imagine what they would argue is that what put an end to that process is the actual putting things down. When we start to get Mark and Luke and Matthew and that stuff, that the actual existence of documents that have sort of captured where they give a lot of creativity to Mark. I mean, it's not just Mark is gathering this stuff together. They keep saying, Mark put this in. Mark thought this, so he put this in Jesus' mouth, and so on. They really do see Mark as using Jesus as a mouthpiece for his own agenda. But I could guess that they would say that after you get documents like that, those documents become the focus then, and it becomes harder to make stuff up.
So once they put a pen to paper, they develop some integrity. But before then, they were...
No, I don't think it wouldn't have to be integrity. It would just be when it's written down and the copies are going around, it gets harder to mess with it because now people can say, oh, wait a minute, I thought it said this over here. Oh, yeah.
But why would they care?
Yeah, well... and I don't know what they would say to that. I mean, Yes?
What's eschatological mean?
Okay. Eschatological is the study of the last things. So eschatological has to do with, if Christians today are having a debate about when is Jesus coming back, and he's coming back secretly to take away the church 7 years before he comes back in glory, and there's this period of the tribulation, and the Antichrist comes, and all that kind of stuff, and somebody else comes along and says, no, I don't think that's true. He's going to come at the end, and all of those kinds of things. Those kinds of debates are all about eschatology, about the end. In this context, the issue for them is whether Jesus was eschatological in his views at all. Whether he looked ahead to a time when the Messiah would come and establish God's kingdom and all of that kind of stuff. He says that a lot in the Gospels, in the Olivet Discourse. The Son of Man will come and his angels will gather up the elect and all of that kind of stuff. They're saying he didn't say any of those things. See, other scholars might not agree, they might not believe that Jesus was actually the Messiah that he claimed to be, but they would say, but there was this guy who went around saying he was. I mean, just one of many religious figures of the time who said he was a Messiah. The Jesus Seminar is saying no, he did not have an eschatological view of things. He was just a sage. He was just a picture, kind of a Socrates kind of guy walking around saying wise things. And it was other people who put the stuff about the kingdom of God and everything in his mouth.
So, by their philosophy, in 30 years when they're all dead, we could go to the book that they've written and cross out stuff saying they didn't say some of the things I said.
Right.
Well,
is that an accurate?
No.
Or am I missing something there?
Their response to that would be no, of course not, because we are bringing objective, scientific criteria to bear on the question of what does and does not belong there. And if you were to bring objective scientific criteria to bear on our text, you would end up concluding that we said what we said, because science works. So they're not giving you permission. They're saying the reason that we can do it to Jesus is that he didn't say those things, and science shows us that he didn't. Whereas science would show that we did because we did. So no, I think they would claim we're being entirely consistent.
I can come with an a priori assumption that Marcus Ford doesn't exist.
That's true.
but see, part of it now it has to deal with the fact is that that a priori assumption they have about supernaturalism is an assumption that is shared by many in our culture. So they can operate out of it and assert it without really feeling the need to defend it, because there are many people that will not challenge it. And they've already said that anybody that does challenge it is showing, by the very fact that they challenge it, that they are naive and superstitious. So people who don't agree with me are naive and superstitious. People who do agree with me are enlightened and wise. Why do I need to defend it? Yes.
What did they have to gain by showing that Jesus wasn't the Christ? Because it wouldn't have been just to justify their own disbelief, because most people would just say, well, that's religious crock, so we throw it out, it's not even scientific. So it's not like they have to prove that Jesus existed but wasn't the Christ. So why are they doing that?
Well, yeah, there are different parts to that picture. The yes? Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, what is it that they had to gain by demonstrating that Jesus was not the Christ, or do I put it that he never claimed to be the Christ, is their issue. And I think it would be, appropriately, I think we as human beings want to find explanations for the things around us. And I do have this Bible that an awful lot of people have read and put stock in. So it's a phenomenon that I want to be able to explain. And that in and of itself is not a bad motivation. I think, like I said, I think for some of the guys in the Jesus seminar, it has become what they have to gain by showing. They're not showing that he wasn't the Christ, they're showing that he never claimed to be the Christ. And that's important to them because there's enough that they like about this guy Jesus that they would like to like him better. That is, like, you can like him, you can, he becomes, as Funk said, we need to tell a new gospel with this other guy at the heart of it, and the story they tell, because see, the Jesus that emerges from this is a guy who said wise sayings, but basically his thing in life was he was egalitarian, everybody was equal, he was for the poor, against rich people, and now I'm sorry. This is a cheap shot. I think I've been pretty fair, so I'm going to take one cheap shot. Maybe some of you would say I've taken some already, but I don't think I have. But now I'm going to take a cheap shot. He's a guy that looks just like them. His politics are their politics. His values are their values. He, on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, they appeal to nothing, they have no argument, but they say, we all voted and we decided that Jesus was not celibate. Basically because, how could he be a guy that we could like if he would be celibate? I mean, it basically comes down to that. I mean, look, at Mary Magdalene is around and everything. I mean, you're really going to say, I mean, that's basically what they say. We think, we believe that Jesus had significant relationships with several women. No, I mean, there is no argument for that. They just say it. Well, that gets to be kind of a pattern to this. They like this guy that they have put up to be Jesus. And not only that, but the fact that he, it's, I mean, we already have other guys like that, But the fact that we could say that Jesus is a guy like that means that we, like I said before, we have rescued Jesus. We have taken Jesus away from the Christians. That Jesus that the Christians believe in, which is so bad. And literally, you can find in their writings, you know, they're saying, so much of what's wrong with Western civilization comes back to Christianity. And if we could discover the real Jesus, then we could work our way out of the mess that Christianity has gotten us into, and we could find our way to a new... You know, you're not going to have those evil Christians saying things like homosexuality is evil. Because Jesus was an egalitarian sort of guy who accepted everybody.
So they're undermining the Christianity by taking away Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, and they... they think they're doing... I mean, they're saying it explicitly. That's what we're doing. We're undermining Christianity by taking Jesus away from the Christians. That's, they say that. I mean, I'm not making that up. They say that.
Bill.
Yeah.
So, do they have a picture of salvation, and how do they deal with books like Hebrews and other things that go back to the Old Testament and look at Abraham and the significant things that happened?
Right. I don't know the answer to that, the second part of that. It really starts to depend on who you're talking about now when you get down to a question like that. Someone like Marcus Borg at Oregon State is one who... he's very vocal about that he believes in God and considers himself a Christian. He is a Christian. He says things like, you know, come to God and discover Jesus, and it will change your life. But part of what he means is it's going to change your life when you find out that Jesus isn't this guy that you thought he was, but he's this other guy. I mean, he has one of Borg's things that he says is, I can't believe in the picture of God that we see in the Bible. Because, for instance, you have God in the Old Testament rescuing Israel from captivity and slavery in Egypt. Now, that's the kind of thing that God would do. But I can't believe that story because look at all the other people in the world that have been in slavery that God didn't step in and miraculously part the Red Sea and all of that sort of thing. That's not fair. And the God that I believe in wouldn't do that. So... I don't believe in the miraculous, not because the one who is behind all of this, and it's a little vague exactly what sort of a being we're talking about, but the one who's behind all this, it's not that I don't think he's up to it, but he never would. Somebody comes along and tells you that God did a miracle, that's to say that God decided to do a miracle over here and he didn't do it over here. And that's unbelievable. To Marcus Borg, that's not possible. God wouldn't do that. So, but we understand when we come to that, that flies right in the face. The Bible itself, from beginning to end, the consistent picture that it paints is of a God who decides to do what he wants to do. So that's, you know, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. You know, I chose you guys. You're small, you're insignificant, and that's what I like about you. And, I mean, that's the picture of God. Marx Borg is saying, well, I believe in God, but not that God. So we have to get that stuff out of the Bible, but still we can encounter God in there if we can get all of that stuff out of the way. Oh, so many hands. Yes.
Was Jesus crucified according to them? And why?
That's a very good question. And many people have raised that question with them. And they have an explanation, and I have to admit, I don't think I know it at the moment, but the question has been raised by many times, this picture of Jesus as this guy who is just a laconic sage who went around just saying, consider the lilies of the field, be nice to everybody, and, you know, and say a few provocative things here and there. And the people have asked the question, why would somebody crucify a laconic sage? And I don't know what their answer would be, but I'm sure they have one. I mean, they're not stupid people. But they have to disentangle the story of the crucifixion from, I mean, all of that stuff about this is King of the Jews and, you know, his dialogue with Pilate over all of that kind of thing, all of that has to be stripped out, because what they're saying is he didn't think those things. He never claimed to be the Messiah. So he wasn't crucified for claiming to be the Messiah because he never claimed that. Yes?
How do they rationalize that with Old Testament prophecy? Do they not deal with that then? Like in Isaiah, places where it talks about Jesus not speaking and preempts crucifixion so clearly, what do they do with those old documents that...
Well, I think they have a way of dealing with that, because since so much of what we find in the Gospels was made up by the disciples, the answer would be, if you were going to make up a Messiah, wouldn't you make up the story so that it fit the prophecies in the Old Testament? And so, I'm not sure, but...
I'd be pretty in tune with the Old Testament to meet all those prophecies.
Right, but that's true. But I think, I mean, they obviously, they're quite straightforward in saying they don't believe in predictive prophecies, so... If it lines up, I mean that's fair. If everything else about their case was right, you could say, well, it would make sense that if these guys are going to make this stuff up, they would make it up in a way that's consistent with what they
already believe. They probably do with all miracles in the Old Testament too, as well.
Right. Oh yes, absolutely. Yes.
If I understand the criteria of dissimilarity, you could apply that to the teachings of any religious leader, whether it's the teachings of Muhammad or Buddha or Christ.
Right.
So in this case, they used it in the paradigm of the West, which is Christianity.
Right.
Do we have two camps then? The camps of those who have a faith and a camp of those who do not?
I think
in a scientific methodology.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Not to say there's a conspiracy, but it seems like it's boiled down to those two camps.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's right. There are certainly distinctions among the people within those two camps as well, but I think that's fair.
Because what I've noticed in Buddhism, you don't have this skepticism of the teachings.
Right.
But as, in particular in Japan, as the country became more westernized and more scientific in its methods, the skepticism increased. So, and that's what I'm wondering, is it the modernization of man?
Well, it certainly has gone along with modernization. I mean, it's, for us, really the Enlightenment was the beginning of it. And it's not, I mean, you understand from where I'm coming from, I'm not against the spirit of inquiry. I mean, to ask the question, did these things happen, is a legitimate question. And to ask, is it reasonable to think they happened and so on, is a reasonable question. But what you decide you're going to work with in the process says it is not just a function of being committed to reason. It has a lot to parts other commitments as well. Terry.
If Borg has rejected this God based upon something like freeing the Israelites from slavery because his God wouldn't do that to all those other people, what is his God then, as far as, he seems like he'd be a very impotent God because he's not doing anything. I mean, there are people in slavery.
And I don't know enough about him. I mean, there are different directions that people go with that kind of a picture of God, and I don't know which Borg does. I mean, he's written some books on that. His view of God is out there, but I haven't read enough of his stuff to know. Yes, Ryan.
Can you speculate on why it ended up on ABC? I mean, how did he get a hearing over other Bible scholars who've been working on this for...
Because this is one of the things that a number of people have commented on. Because of this evangelistic fervor of people like Robert Funk and Cresson and Borg and people like that, they set out from the beginning, when they put the Jesus Seminar together, one of the items on their agenda was to get a lot of attention.